Okay, so our speaker today is Carlo, who's going to speak about searching for quantum gravitational observations.
Okay, great. Thank you, Jorge. Can I get a yes that you're hearing me? I'm not talking to the emptiness.
Yes, no problem.
Okay, good. So I am going to report on work done in the last year. And appeared in four papers, which are in the first slide, and done in collaboration with Hao, Francesca Naurili, and Barreau. What I'm presenting is one specific technical result and a number of ideas which go together, suggesting a possibility toward quantum gravitational observations. Which I think is new and might be interesting. It's just a suggestion. The starting point, let's go to slide two. If we take the theory that we all like and love, loop quantum gravity, and we ask the question which I think we should always ask, namely, what can we do with this theory? Besides just playing with it, how can we go toward phenomenology? I think that the strongest result and the one more in which there have been more convergence and more work has been built over it is comes from the application of loop theory to cosmology, from loop quantum cosmology, and is summarized in the equation which is there, which of course is the Friedman equation. The black is the Friedman equation, with a correction, which is the correction coming from loop quantum gravity, where rho Planck is the Planck density. Now, of course, a lot has been done with this equation and its variants, with including other aspects of cosmology. But I want to focus on the physics that this equation suggests, which is, as is written in the slide, the idea that when the energy density of matter, rho, approaches rho Planck, Planckian density, there is a weakening of the gravitational attraction, or if you want, a repulsive force which balances the gravitational attraction. And everything that follows is sort of based on the idea of taking this weakening of gravity at high matter density seriously and applying and see what kind of physics we can do with it besides the early universe. Now, this idea that there is an effect like that, it's in fact suggested by a number of other inputs. So if we go to slide number three, besides the loop quantum cosmology bounds, I've mentioned the idea of a maximal curvature, which comes together with a minimal scale, and related to that, maximal acceleration, but also something much simpler, which is the simple observation that quantum mechanics very often prevents an excessive concentration of stuff. If you just think of the electron or the hydrogen atom, the electron doesn't fall on the center of the Coulomb potential because there is a Heisenberg uncertainty principle which sort of keeps it open. So it's like one cannot squeeze an electron for too much time in a too small region. So I think one can start, and one can try to take a general reasonable hypothesis, which is written in blue on the slide, which is that quantum mechanics prevent the formation of singularities of generativistic singularities by developing a repulsion when matter reaches a Planck density. Now, what I'm going to do is apply this idea to black holes following similar ideas, which have been studied by various people both outside the loop community and inside the loop community. In the loop community, there were independently the Leonardo and Abai and Bojewald, and later these ideas have been developed by Modesto himself and his collaborator in One Direction, and by Gambini and Poulin recently. So the idea is to consider this repulsion, this pressure of this repulsive force when matter reaches the energy density, and use it to understand how quantum mechanics may affect black hole. Let me go to slide number four and just talk about black holes a moment in general, just to clarify the ideas. When I studied black holes at the university, there were no black holes. My teacher told me that black holes were a funny solution of the Einstein equations, which most likely had nothing correspondent to it in the universe. And in fact, this is what is still written in Weinberg's master book, Gravitation and Cosmology, which is one of the best books on general relativity. And you can check it at the end of the chapter on the Schwarzschild solution. It says that most likely there are no black holes in the universe. Now, Weinberg is a scientist, is a serious scientist, so he doesn't say I'm sure there are not. He says it does not seem to have, Schwarzschild singularity does not seem to have much relevance in the world, and he gives argument for that. And of course, the reaction, let's go to slide number five, is to ask Stephen, he's a great scientist, but he was obviously wrong there, so are you sure, Stephen? Today, 40 years later, black holes are an astrophysical object. There are thousands and thousands of black holes in the sky, stellar black holes that are seen by the astronomers, and there are black holes in the center of galaxies, huge. More precisely, there are astrophysical objects which are quite well described as far as we can see and for what we can measure by black hole solutions to the Einstein equations. Let's go to following slide number six. So we see black holes in the sky, and we see a large amount of matter falling into the black hole. First, most stellar black holes, at least, are believed to be that they were formed by a collapse of a star. But then we see the accretion disks. This is the first object in the sky that was identified as a black hole, this is Sinus X1. It's not an exclamation mark, it's a 1 there. What we see is the X-rays emitted by the accretion disk. So there's a matter falling in. So we know with a good confidence that there are regions of space-time described by black holes and where matters fall. And I think that the key question, the key physical question, that this question which is interesting in gravity, is the one in slide 7, namely what happens to the matter that falls in. We see all this matter falling into the black hole. What happens to it? Where does it go? Imagine that we could follow it, or just cross the horizon, and most likely general relativity, the picture of classical general relativity is reliable across the horizon, so matter falls toward r equals zero, then what happens? Now, slide number 8, again, the question is what happens to all matter falling to black hole? The geometry is sketched there in the Edison Finkelstein coordinates. So there is r equal to m, and the arrows represent matter falling in. And of course, what we know is that when matter approaches r equals zero, generativity becomes unreliable because of quantum effects. And the question is what happened there. Now, slide number 9. Before sort of moving toward the obvious answer, let me look at scales here. Imagine that we have a star with a stellar dimension. So the sun, right? Sun is a sort of 1,000 times the Earth, 10 to the 13 centimeters scale. Now, when it collapses, a star size of the sun, or a bit larger, its horizon is of the order of a kilometer, right? The Schwarzschild radius of the sun is order of a kilometer. So that's black hole scale. This is whatever, 38 order of magnitudes larger than the Planck length. So the Planck length is enormously smaller there. But if we think at a collapsing star, when it reaches the Planck density, is not when its size is the Planck length. It's much, much larger. In fact, it's 20 orders of magnitude larger is what is indicated as Planck's star there. Planck density, just one line calculation, is reached roughly when the radius is the order of the third cubic root of the mass of the star in standard units. So if we go to the next slide, slide number 10, what I want to point out here is that quantum gravity becomes relevant not at a distance which is a Planck scale distance from the r equals zero, but a hugely larger distance, 20 order of magnitude larger distance, which is when matter reaches a Planck density, if we believe the suggestion that comes from cosmology and the other suggestions that says that the onset of quantum mechanics, what concerns gravity, is given by the matter density or the curvature to becoming becoming Planckian. This fact was its density, and therefore macroscopic objects can become affected by quantum gravity, was pointed out by Abadi and his collaborators Pavlovsky and Singh in the context of cosmology, where they noticed that even a closed universe which bounces, it's going to bounce depending on the matter content at the scale, when it has a scale, it's much, much larger than the Planck scale. So let's go to slide 11. What is a likely picture? Well, as has been discussed by many authors, a likely picture, if we believe the suggestions from quantum gravity, is that at some scale, which I've indicated here are in the space-time diagram, the attraction of gravity is balanced by quantum effects, so therefore the light cones turn up, there is an internal horizon, and whatever falls in doesn't go to r equals zero, but might sort of slow down and not disrupt space-time at r equals zero. Matrix where this is possible have been written by various people. For this is an example by Hayward, 2006 is written down. Now, slide 12, we know that the external horizon of a black hole shrinks for quantum gravitational effects because of Hawking radiation. So at some point, the most likely thing that happens is that the internal horizon and the external horizon are going to join, and whatever comes in comes out. So this is a picture that has been proposed for black holes by various people, and this is the picture from which our work starts. Namely, there is an internal horizon, there is a repulsive force, or a weakening of the gravitational force at short distance or high density, and the internal horizon and external horizon merge, and what falls in comes out. Now, in slide 13, I've just drawn the space diagrams a little bit like more like a relativist should do, namely in a Penrose-Carter diagram, where the r equals zero singularity, of course, is horizon is not vertical, and the question what happens to matter now is properly reformulated as what happened to matter in when it gets up to where those question marks are. So this is a question on which our work starts. This is a set of ideas on which our work is based, or formulated in another manner. In slide 14, there are three space time diagrams, the three Penrose diagram, that of a non-evaporating black hole, one of a black hole that evaporates, but still there is a singularity which we don't know how to treat, and the likely picture at the light of quantum gravity where there's no singularity whatsoever, and the what comes in comes out, there is the black closed line represents the external and internal horizons, which sort of separates and then meet again. So the question is that can we make precise, and what is the physics of the matter that comes out from there? I mean, can we write a metric for the rightmost diagram, which is not just an arbitrary guess, which sort of funny things happen can we get a sense, or can we guess what could be the actual geometry of the rightmost diagram? And the idea here is in slide 15. Is so the physical problem is how can matter and energy can come out from the whole region. The key idea is the first approximation to neglect Hawking radiation. Hawking radiation takes an immense amount of time to disrupt a black hole. On the other hand, it shows that quantum effects can disrupt a black hole. Quantum gravitational effects can disrupt a black hole before the Hawking radiation. This is the question I'm asking. So let's neglect entirely Hawking radiation. Then we can assume energy conservation at infinity. What comes in comes out. And the idea is that the coming in and going out of the matter can be represented as an elastic bounce. Now, generativity is time reversal invariant. So if we know how things fall, we know how things come out. Imagine a ball that falls on the ground. It's easy to see what happens next. It just comes out with a motion which, to first approximation, if you disregard the dissipative effect, is exactly the time reversal of the motion it went in. Let's go to slide 16. This is what I want to do. I wanted to take the space-time of something collapsing, time reverse it, and glue the two pieces. That's what I want to do, thinking that this might represent what happens to a black hole. Now, at first sight, this sounds totally wrong for a number of reasons. Let's go to slide 17. The lowest part of the diagram is a black hole. The upper part of the diagram is a white hole. And let's go to slide 18. Everybody knows that there are no white holes in the universe, right? We studied that at school. We were told that at school by our teacher. So let's go to slide 19, which is just a reminder of my teacher telling me that there are no black holes. And let's go to slide 20, which is a book, which refers to a book by Bob Wald, shortly later, in which he argued very convincingly that there are no white holes. And why there are no black holes, white holes? Because there is no reason to believe that there are initial configurations that could lead into a white hole. But as Stephen perhaps should have been more cautious in saying there are no black holes, it's possible that also Bob perhaps should have been more cautious in saying that there are no white holes. Because the objects that we see in the sky are not described exactly by a black hole solution. By a black hole solution, all the way to the singularity. So it's possible that in the sky there are things which are described by a white hole solution all the way from the singularity, okay? And the singularity could be what? Well, it could be the quantum region from which matter comes in after the bounce. So slide 21, generativity has predicted a extraordinary sequence of phenomena what believed at first, including Einstein. Einstein did not believe in black holes, did not believe in expansion of universe, did not believe in gravitational waves, and of course did not believe in white holes. But all these have come out to be true. All these solutions of Einstein equations have come out to be true. This work is sort of a suggestion that perhaps also the white holes, which have been badly disregarded so far, might play a role in the grand scheme of things. So slide 22, first message, which of course I will argue now a little bit more concretely about this, white holes can be out there in the sky, or more precisely regions of space-time which are, to some approximation, described by white holes, not that the singularity itself, of course, can be out there in the sky. So let's see if this is possible and go to slide 23. And at first, it seems completely impossible. Why? Because suppose we want to glue the lower black hole and the upper white hole. Now, we know that this, in fact, black hole and white hole sit together in the Kruskal solution. The lowest space-time diagrams is just the Kruskal solution. But the other way around, black hole comes after and white hole comes first. So it seems impossible to glue a black hole and a white hole if not imagine that the entire universe disappears and reappears in another way. It seems impossible to imagine that there's a space-time where there's a small region. Everything is classical outside. There's a small region which becomes a black hole and then sort of magically becomes a white hole. How is it possible? Slide 24. This is what I would like, and this is what seems impossible. I would like a space-time in which there are no, there is a trivial causal structure, so it's like in the diagram here. The blue region one is flat. Something collapses, and here, for simplicity, I take a null collapsing shell, just because it's easier to do calculation than a massive time-like shell. Outside it is Schwarzschild, so the region 2 is Schwarzschild. Everything is symmetric around t equals 0, so the future is just equal to the past, but time reversed. So the horizontal line, there's a t equals 0, is light of symmetry. There might be a quantum region 3, but it's finite, it doesn't extend outside it. And the green lines are the r equal to m, the horizon, that forms, external horizon that form, and we believe that generativity is valuable inside the horizon. So we want the Schwarzschild solution to continue inside the horizon. The quantum region should just be not just the other side of the horizon. And the question is that, is there any solution of Einstein equation of that sort? And because of what I said in the previous slide, it seems very difficult for this to exist. But slide 25, slide 25 is just repeated what I just said now, so let's go to slide 26. There is a solution, and the solution is illustrated in this slide 26 with a sort of metaphor of the crossed finger. In fact, once you digest this picture, you understand exactly what is happening in the following. So on the left panel, there's a Kruskal solution, just a standard Kruskal matrix, the maximum extension of Schwarzschild. And there are two gray areas. Let's just focus on the dark gray area. Imagine you take this dark gray area, you cut it, and these are conformal pictures, so you can deform things as you wish, provided that you just keep 45 degrees as they are. Imagine that you just drew the epsilon lower, so you redraw it as in the gray area in the right panel. And now you can glue to it the light gray area in the future of it. In other words, you can take the two crossed fingers of the left-hand panel, open them up, and insert a small quantum region inside. And what you get is a space-time metric which is Schwarzschild in both dark and gray area, and of course glued correctly across the boundary between the dark gray and the light gray, and it's still the same solution as before, still Kruskal. The dotted lines are the horizon, and it's exactly what we wanted. It's something that enters into a black hole, goes through a quantum region, and exits to a white hole. Let's go to slide number 27. Once you have digested that, it's just a matter of sitting down and writing this in algebraic form, and writing explicitly the solution in and doing the right gluing along the boundaries. So the space-time I'm building is the one in the diagram. There is an incoming shell, null shell, which bounces at r equals 0 and bounces out, so it goes out. Inside the shell, like always in generativity, is a symmetric shell, it's just Minkowski. Outside it, in the region 2, is just Schwarzschild, and as I've told you, the two things glue nicely, and glue nicely with a future where it is the same thing but time reversed. So this is a null shell entering its horizon, going through a quantum region, Xing the horizon on the other side. Of course, one has to do some work to glue things properly, and to glue things properly, one has to notice that the radius is the same, it's continuous across the gluing of the various region and so on. I'm not going through all this this algebra, is technically a bit boring, but it's completely straightforward. All this defines the metric, And the entire matrix now depends on four constants. They're four free constants. One is m, this is the bottom line of still of slide 27, which is the mass. The mass is the mass of the null shell. A null shell has a certain energy, so there's a mass associated to it. And is the mass of the Schwarzschild solution, which you see outside the shell. Then let me skip V0 for a moment. Delta is a parameter that essentially says determines the position of capital delta in the upper in the diagram. Namely, it says how far quantum effects must go for this to happen. Epsilon is a parameter that says when the shell enters a quantum region, and is determined by the idea that the shell enters a quantum region when the density is Planckian. So the two free parameters are V0 and delta. Let's go to slide 28. Again, that's what I said. N is the mass of the shell. Oh. Is there a question?
Yeah. Yes. Can you go back to 27, please?
27, yes. Hi. Bye.
In region 3, Einstein's equations don't hold?
No, region 3 Einstein equation don't hold. In fact, all the construction refers to region 1 and 2. The metric that is written there in region 3 is an arbitrary how do you say in English? Is interpolating between the two metrics without solving the Einstein equation.
Okay, so there is a lot of freedom in this. So the metric in this region 3 is pretty undetermined, except for the matching conditions.
The fact that it depends only on four constants, it regards to region 1 and 2, not region 3, where it's completely determined so far.
It's completely undetermined. It is anything, but you just wrote down some continuation. Is that correct?
I just wrote down something that looks reasonable that interpolates between the two.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. So, slide 28, I just repeat the meaning of the four parameters.
Another
the key parameters is...
Sorry.
Okay. Yes?
Hi, Carlo. This is Eugenio. I just wanted to ask, in region 3, are you also assuming that the curvature is Planck scale or it's not needed?
No, there is no assumption. We didn't, in fact, what we expect by, I'm going to get to that, what we expect region 3, this is where quantum theory should hold. So this is not a true metric, this is an effective metric representing the transition between sort of before singularity and after the singularity. There's no special request we made on the metric on region 3 so far.
Okay, thank you. Okay, but so in particular that means that, I mean, you can't know Planck scale, right? Because your theory doesn't know anything about Planck scale unless you put the h-bar by hand somewhere. The metric has no h-bar in it, so it cannot know about Planck scale. And so this really, to say it effective is also not quite right, because typically, like in loop quantum cosmology, the effective metric knows about Planck scale, Planck constant. So here really is a mathematical continuation of the metric that you know in region 1 and 2. You're just continuing it in any smooth manner. Between in this in-between region. You're just calling it quantum for the sake of, simplicity or something. I mean, it's physically it's not necessarily quantum because there's no metric has no h-bar in it whatsoever.
No. For the moment, it's just a metric. And then it depends on this constant, and the internal part is depends on much more. It's just chosen. In fact, if you look at it in detail, it's just a simple modification of the Kruskal metric inside. But which is not a solution, it's an equation, of course.
Right.
Now you'll see how the Planck constant come in a moment, in determining this constant. Because the idea is that this metric is meant to represent what happens to a bouncing star, and so when, in particular, the parameter epsilon is just the size of the null shell when it enters the quantum region. So now as an input, I want to determine epsilon. Let's go to slide 28. Epsilon is determined by demanding that that we enter the quantum region. And we assume that when the density is sufficiently high, we enter the quantum region. So epsilon is determined by M Planck. You see M Planck in the little equation where it talks about epsilon. The key parameter, however, is V0. V0 is roughly how much time it takes the shell to bounce out. And this is an important part of the story. So we have two arguments for determining V0, two weak arguments for determining V0. One is from above, so a maximum value of V0. And it's just using the firewall argument, which I'm not going to repeat here because it would take too much time. The firewall argument says that something must go wrong if one consider Hawking radiation and if nothing happens before a certain time, before page time. So if one assumes, this is very indirect, if one assumes that this process, this bounce we are considering, happens sufficiently early for allowing the firewall not to happen, for preventing the firewall situation to develop, this gives a maximal lifetime for this process to happen. More interesting, let's go to slide 30, is an argument from below. So let's imagine that this might happen because of quantum mechanics. Of course, let me remind the logic. Outside the region 3, everything is classical, so there's no problem. Inside the region 3, quantum mechanics. So we want the classical theory, or the semi-classical theory, to be violated at some point. So when is the closest possibility, where is the shortest possibility to violate the theory? As long as the curvature is not too high, and as long as not too time passes, you are in the classical theory and you cannot violate the classical theory. So there are two conditions that we considered that could lead to a violation of the classical theory. Either the curvature becomes Planckian, or, point two, the curvature is not Planckian, but there are small corrections, so there's sufficiently long time for quantum mechanics to act. The typical example of that is tunneling. Tunneling is a phenomenon that happens in regions where nothing seems to be Planckian in a short time, but the time is sufficiently long for the action to become of the order of the Planck scale and so on and so forth. So we use these two conditions, and let's go to slide 31. In slide 31, there is on the right a space-time diagram, and look at the blue line. The blue line is the path of an observer which sits at a fixed radius, a fixed distance from the center, a fixed Schwarzschild radius. And we might demand how long would such observer need for just dimensionally quantum effects to happen. So one can define a classicality parameter Q, which is the curvature times the proper time of the observer, times the Planck length, and roughly dimensionally, when Q is the order of 1, this is the earliest that one might expect quantum gravity to come in. When Q is small with respect to 1, there is no reason to expect quantum mechanics to act. So we have a metric, which I compute this, I skip you the full computation, and what comes out is remarkable. Namely, the earliest happens at a radius which is 7 over 6 to m, so just outside the Schwarzschild radius, and at a time which is order m square in natural unit. Now, time of order m square is very long, but is shorter than the Hawking time. So let's go to slide 32. Let's take this sort of minimal bouncing time as let's study it. And this suggests that the time I sit at a distance just outside of this of the black hole, or some finite distance outside, and there's a long time tau, proper time for observers at fixed distance, of the order of m squared, for the shell to go in and bounce out. Now this seems very strange, and in fact this makes no sense at first sight before one understands what's going on. So to understand what's going on, let's go to slide 33, and I discuss an example. So this is a self-contained example here in slide 33, which explains what goes on. This is a little exercise in classical general relativity. No quantum, everything is totally classical and well-defined here. So imagine the following situation. Imagine a ball which has a mirror on the on its surface, so it's a, we call it the crystal ball, and which has a radius A. And imagine that there is a shell concentric to the ball of light coming from infinity, bouncing on the ball and bouncing out. And the space-time diagram is written there. So the red is the world line of the shell, the gray is the ball, and it bounces out. Now suppose you sit at a distance capital R away from the ball, so outside the ball. You see the shell coming in, bouncing, and going out. And the proper time for you is tau, or twice tau. Question, how much is tau? Well, I mean, as long as you are away from a relativistic situation, tau is obviously the distance, your distance from the mirror, right? It's just the light takes, the time it takes light to go from you to the mirror and bounce back. But as soon as A, the radius of the ball is massless here, its mass is irrelevant, becomes smaller and approaches the Schwarzschild radius of the incoming shell, given by the mass of the incoming shell, tau becomes longer and longer and longer, and the formula is given there, it's a little exercise.
We seem to have lost the speaker. I doubt it. Anyone call him on his phone, cell phone?
Yes, I'm trying.
Okay.
I can also.
Yeah, well, only one of us should call. So, Lee, if you are calling, we'll stop.
Hello?
Yes, we hear you.
Hello?
Go ahead.
I'm back. Where did you lose me? Did you lose me?
The point is that you are giving a demonstration of this very long time. So you are very close to my call, and we were out in, at infinity, right?
There is this sphere with a mirror, a bouncing light over it, and the time of a the proper time of an observer who sits at the distance between the moment he sees the light coming in, going in, and the light, the moment he sees the light going out, diverges if the size of the ball becomes near the Schwarzschild radius of the shell. So in other words, to see what happened, go to the next slide, 34. This is in sort of Schwarzschild-like coordinates. This is not a precise picture. You sit at a distance, and you see the light going near the ball, slowing down, because remember that in your own time, you don't see things falling into the black hole. You see things slowing down, approaching the horizon. And after a very long time, it comes out. The light comes out. It touches the mirror and comes out. So when the light, when the sphere becomes smaller and smaller, this time becomes longer and longer, diverges, it goes to infinity. It goes to infinity if the sphere becomes, the radius of the sphere becomes equal to the Schwarzschild radius. The idea here is that quantum mechanics keeps this bouncing time finite, because the light shell can bounce out in a finite time, very long but finite. So slide 35, this is the moral of the story. Take full metric that I've constructed, and there are two blue lines here, one vertical in r equals 0, and one at fixed r outside the horizon. And the proper time inside is of order m, the proper time outside is of order m squared. Now, to make things clear, for a stellar object, m is order of milliseconds, m squared is order of billion years. So if this picture is correct, what a black hole is a bounce seen at slow motion. So inside the black hole, you just jump out to a far future. If you sit inside the black hole, what you see is a very fast shell of light coming in and bouncing out. But, you know, general relativity is time dilation. This is the main effect of time general relativity. So if you see the same thing from the outside, because of the huge time dilation given by the sort of huge Newtonian potential when the shell becomes small, this takes a very, very long time. So let's go to 36. This gives a picture, and the picture is that black holes may explode in a time m squared. Can this lead to anything observable? Well, m squared is still very long for anything stellar black holes, and even more for a galactic black hole. But astrophysicists and cosmologists have considered the possibility that there are all sorts of black holes formed in the early universe. So let's see if a primordial black hole in the early universe could be created at the time, be formed at the time, and bounce up today. So let's take the assumption that there are primordial black holes, and there are primordial black holes of all masses. Then, since we know the lifetime of the black hole, I'm believing this picture, if this picture gives the lifetime of black hole as a function of the mass, we can reverse this and compute the mass as a function of its lifetime, which was it's the Hubble time. And the mass turns out to be of the order of 10 to the 23 kilograms, sort of small satellite, a continent. And this is the radius, the corresponding Schwarzschild radius is a millimeter. So there is a possible physical picture, which is primordial black hole collapsing in the early universe, bouncing immediately out, but because of time dilation, they're only appearing today, and the theory says that their size will be of the order of a millimeter. How can we get a millimeter? Well, we get a millimeter just from, because there's a huge ratio, which is the ratio of the Hubble time to the Planck time, 10 to the 60, which scales up the Planck size to a millimeter. The square root of that scales up the Planck size to a millimeter. This is slide 37. Now let's go to slide 30. Hello?
Question? Yes, Lee, a question.
Yes.
How precise is this estimate of tau as being m squared? Because if a solar mass gives 10 to 9 years, then a typical stellar black hole, which is more like 10 solar masses, gives 10 to 11 years. But if you got a few factors of pi or 3 in there, you could get this down to within the Hubble scale.
It's not precise because there is a lot of phenomena that we have not studied yet, just because we have not the time to study. For instance, rotation. I suppose that for a Kerr black hole, a different factor would come in, and so on and so forth. Then this is a null shell collapsing, so a realistic collapsing object is not null and is not a single shell. So I think this has to be if this is reasonable, it's only reasonable in vague order of magnitudes, no more than that.
Okay, thank you.
So let's go to slide 38. So imagine that this happened. What would this give? It would give a high energy component because all the photons trapped in the black hole will come out in high energy. But let me skip this because I am short of time and I want to go to the low energy component. So let me go to slide 39. The low energy component. Why there is a low energy component? Well, very simply, because if there's something of the order of a millimeter or centimeters that explodes, there will be in its signal a component of the order of the size of the object, right? So if you have something which is the size of a centimeter or millimeter with a huge energy exploding, there will be certain part of its emitted energy, which is in a wavelength of a millimeter or centimeter. So let's go to slide 40. Now, I don't want to overstress that, but when we discovered that, we could not resist being excited. There are signals which are called fast radio bursts, which have been first observed by Parkes radio telescope, and sort of nobody believed them because they were the only ones seeing that. But then they have been also observed by the Arecibo radio telescope in Puerto Rico. And they are considered quite mysterious. They have a duration of milliseconds. They have a frequency of around a gigahertz. And they are most likely extragalactic because in the radio is pretty easy to see how far some signal come from. They have a very big power, and the papers that represent them stress that the physical source so far is completely unknown. So let's go to slide 41. On the one hand, we have a tentative prediction, which of course relies on a lot of hypotheses, both theoretical hypotheses plus existence of more black holes. But it's a prediction of a powerful burst of the order of a millimeter or centimeters. On the other side, we have observed signals with a wavelength of 20 centimeters. A gigahertz is an order of 20 centimeters, which are extragalactic and have a high power and whose source is unknown. So it's tempting to say,
Carlo, yes. But this 1 centimeter wavelength should be near the object, right? Not at infinity. Because the object is doing something, is about the size of 1 centimeter, and therefore it is really emitting this at some wavelength. I agree it is 1 centimeter, but measured close to the object, not at infinity. Whereas this telescope, if it is extragalactic, is very far away. And therefore the wavelength as seen by if you take your calculation seriously, right, the first calculation where we took this time dilation effect very seriously, for exactly the same reason, the wavelength is going to be very redshifted, so it's going to be quite huge, for the same reason as time dilation. So I'm not understanding how you can make both arguments, and I'm missing something. So could you please help me?
We have not studied the physics of explosion. I mean, here it's a small object which has a certain size. So when we see a black hole in the sky, there is, of course, a huge redshift from the black hole. But there is if we see an accretion disk of a black hole, it's the order of a few times the Schwarzschild radius of the, or 10 times the Schwarzschild radius of the black hole itself. And of course we see signals that have the corresponding wavelength because they're phenomena at that scale. So I am, one of the things that has to be done, of course, is to study the explosion itself and study how the size of black hole affects the signal coming out. That's one of the reasons that for which the 1 centimeter or 1 millimeter comparing to the 20 centimeters, it's I'm not worrying about the difference. On the other hand, I'm not. I don't think that the millimeter and centimeters should be taken within one order of magnitude. But I don't think that a physical collapsing black hole, which has that mass and has a Schwarzschild radius exploding, will have a signal which is only redshifted to infinity. We'll have a signal which has a wavelength of that related to that. This is all to be studied. So this is completely. We have considered this point, and we have not a clear calculation of any sort. Yes, this is just a first connection between two possible things. Let me go to slide 42. So and I'm close to the end, so then I can take questions. I want just to wrap up to avoid the time is finished. So the main message is to consider the possibility that some signal of these signals might be of quantum gravity origin. If there is a bounce of the black holes, if this is roughly of order m squared, like this tentative calculation suggests, and if there are primordial black holes, there might be signals coming from these primordial black holes, and they may be compared either in the low energy spectrum or the high energy spectrum to what we see in the sky. There's a lot of signals in the sky, and this fast radio burst hit us because of the similarity of the wavelength. So, slide 43. I begin my summary. Summary is in a few slides. The first one is a technical result. And the technical result, I want to make it clear because this is the clean part, is that there is a solution of Einstein equation which covers region 1 and 2 of the diagram in slide 43, which is an exact solution of Einstein equation, the vacuum solution of Einstein equation, except for the incoming shell in red, the outgoing shell in red. It has an apparent horizon, which is in green, and except for a finite region in gray, where, of course, not only not a solution of Einstein's equation, but energy conditions are violated because there could not be a proper solution of Einstein's equation with matter that observes the energy conditions that could have a black hole emerging into a white hole. But there is one. And what is interesting is that the quantum region is finite. It's contained in a small region of space-time. So there is nothing in the physics that we know, it seems to me, that prevents the possibility that what we see as a black hole, of course, is not a black hole the way to the singularity, because something that would happen, continue into a white hole, which is not a white hole the way to singularity, because that's where the quantum region is. Slide 44, the physical scenario is a incoming phase with a black hole, or going phase with a white hole. This is no singularity. Information is completely preserved, so there's no information problem here. And the main idea is time dilation. So a rapid bounce can be a very long phenomenon seen from the outside. And so the suggestion is that this might be connected, that there may be signals connected to primordial black holes. Slide 45, and this is a penultimate. So I want to summarize the messages I insisted on. First, quantum gravity can set in black hole physics when a star is 20 order of magnitude larger than the Planck scale, which I didn't expect at all. I didn't believe at all until a few years ago. I've completely changed my mind about that. Second, white holes, I believe, should be taken seriously to describe what happens after the quantum region. Third, I think there is no reason to believe that nothing quantum happens before the Hawking evaporation time. The Hawking evaporation time is huge. Hawking theory shows that black holes can be disrupted by quantum phenomenon, but doesn't talk about quantum gravitational phenomena. So there may be other phenomena doing that. core, I think I already said that, time inside a black hole is different from time outside. So a bouncing star, seeing in slow motion, looks exactly like a black hole. Five, there might be, this I didn't talk about that, the high energy component, there may be high energy gamma rays, which tentatively one can try to identify with primordial black hole exploding. And I found more interesting infrared, radio infrared signals related to the side of the exploding black hole. So my final slide is the 46, where, of course, I don't know if I believe it, but I want to suggest that perhaps this particular signal seen from Arecibo might be a quantum gravity signal. Thank you.
Questions?
Yes, so this is Lee. So it's a very beautiful suggestion, but on the astrophysical side, I have a comment and a suggestion. The comment is really related to Carlo's answer to Abai's question. If I understand right, what you're saying is that there's some primordial black hole we don't know has a formation mechanism. We don't know anything about the frequency. We don't know anything about the rate because we don't know anything about the distribution of early fluctuations that would have caused primordial black holes. But we believe that there are white holes following your suggestion, which are going off now. But your point is that what one is seeing is not some primordial burst of quantum gravity-caused radiation. What one would see is something like a jet with shock waves produced by a gamma ray burst. That is, it's a messy astrophysical situation, and the connection to phenomenology is only very suggestive at this point. Is that fair?
Yes.
So then I'd like to make a suggestion. The suggestion is to not think as much about primordial black holes as to think about real black holes, because as I suggested in my comment, you're within a few rough orders of magnitude of seeing the explosion, if your scenario is right, of this low scale of real astrophysical black holes. So these black holes in a range of 5 to 20 solar masses, which just barely by m squared make it within a cosmological time scale. And those should look a lot like gamma ray bursts, I would think.
Carlo, one of the problems with these fast radio bursts is their characteristics. They go on, they are very short-lived, and they show nothing else. So that is a big problem. So now let me change the topic. So if this suggestion is is possible, then you can think of our system where we do have our signals, and this is related to what Lee was saying. So now think of a gamma ray burst, especially the short gamma ray burst. So those they form a small black hole, so there are mass black holes, and then you would expect these kind of signals that are associated with short gamma ray bursts. So there are plenty of short gamma ray bursts out there that people have followed up in detail, and they haven't seen anything like this. So that would put a tension in the whole picture.
The sound was very bad here. Could you summarize in a shorter?
Right. So you're saying this, you're trying to tie this fast radio burst to an object that is collapsing,
yes,
to a black hole and bouncing, right? So
yes,
now, short gamma ray bursts are believed to,
yes,
form a black hole, and the black hole will have a stellar mass size. I will be shortly, but those are very well identified. The rays are pretty well known. They are followed up, and I don't think they see anything like what you're proposing here.
No, may I answer to this question, I'm Francesca? So if I understand what was said before, is that part of our proposal relies on the fact that there may be also a signal in the in the gamma ray bursts. So it's not true that we perfectly know what are these gamma ray bursts. In fact, we perfectly know what are the long, soft gamma ray bursts. These are just a supernova explosion. And on the other hand, there are hard, fast gamma ray bursts that are of unknown nature. So in this sense, I see the landscape completely open for an identification of those signals with our proposal.
Sorry, I mean, this might be a discussion, but to say it's completely open is being way too pessimistic. I mean, there is plenty of evidence out there, even though that there has to be an old population, the time scale says you have to be a compact object, it also tells you more or less the type of object you're talking about. So it doesn't have to be a binary merger, per se, but it could very well be a magnetar that is going off and then might trigger a collapse. But by now, there is already one observation of kilonova that is that rules out the magnetar picture and is pointing much, much more strongly to a binary that is actually forming a black hole through the merger. So I think, I mean, you cannot just completely ignore all the evidence that is pointing very strongly in that direction.
Sorry, I'm having a lot of difficulty of hearing. There's the noise. Are you saying that the source of the fast radio burst today has been understood clearly? Is that what you're saying?
No. The main problem of the fast radio burst is that you have to explain why it only shines the way it does, very short time scale and only in the radio. So that's a big question. But Lee's point was, okay, now you could think of other scenarios that give much more signal, that we're much better able to identify. And in that, one example would be short gamma ray bursts. And there you form a relatively small black hole, there's a center mass black hole. You follow it with everything, people point all telescopes to them, and then that would be the ideal case to go see if there is such a signal or a signal analog to what you're predicting here comes with the event. And as far as I know, people haven't pointed out that this is a possibility. And
I get one word every four, so I cannot reconstruct what you're saying at all. I apologize.
That's okay. I can't think of
anything. Maybe somebody else can summarize.
I think I can summarize briefly. What he's saying
okay,
is that gamma ray bursts may actually provide a constraint on these ideas. He says that the short bursts there's been some recent evidence that they come from binary black hole mergers or from magnetars, and that it's not clear that they support this scenario.
What is the relation between the gamma ray burst? Is that a comment on what Lee said, or is that a comment on the talk?
I think
it's a comment on what Lee said.
Ah, okay. That's why I was not understanding. Sorry.
Beg to disagree. I think it's a comment on the talk. Okay. So the statement it's both, right? And what Lee said is namely that there are signatures that one should look for. Right? There should also be such things happening for other phenomena, not primordial black holes. So I guess this is part of Lee's suggestion, but it's certainly true with your proposals, that anytime people say black holes form, then your scenario should come and intervene and say they don't form, but rather there is this burst, and therefore one should actually see some associated radiation. And the comment was that for short gamma ray bursts, even though we do not know exactly the mechanism, there are many, all the scenarios today are converging to the statement that there is actually a black hole, whether it is formed by merger or whether it's formed because of this kilotars or magnetars, etc. But there is a black hole there, and therefore once you see such signals, and there is no evidence that there is such signal. So in some sense, it is motivated by Lee said, but it's also addressed to your talk.
It's you like, it puts a constraint on the factor in front of m squared, whether we would expect to be seeing a large population of stellar mass black holes turning into white holes now, if there's a small factor in front of the m squared, or we shouldn't expect to be seeing them yet if there's a large factor in front of the m squared.
I don't know how the scenario I presented could be changed in one way or the other. I believe it might. As it is today, the estimate we have for the lifetime is m squared. So it's as it is today. I mean, Lee's suggestion is interesting, but as it is today, it has no effect whatsoever on the black holes forming today. So it's perfectly compatible with the existence of the black hole within the sky and with a number of black hole formations that one can estimate astrophysically, and the relation, the possible relation of these with short ray, with short gamma ray bursts.
I think experts in astrophysics, we should just go on, because I also have many comments, but again, unless there is real astrophysics experts, we will not be able to decide this. But I think there are more theoretical physics questions that, that for example, Eugenio has. So.
Hello, Carlo.
Hi.
Yeah, I have a theory question. Can you go back to slide 24? I find all this exciting because, in a sense, it opens a new window to quantum gravity, at least in principle. You know, it's really a change of perspective from singularities that are screened always behind event horizons and cosmic censorship, now only trapped surfaces. So you can look into the singularity or into the quantum gravity region. Just that there are new challenges
right
now. So my
right
question is about 24, this diagram, this classical geometry, and about the classical stability. Suppose that you perturb it just a bit. What would happen? And I have an example in mind in particular. Suppose that the black hole just forms in between me and you, and I have a lamp. I have a bulb on, 100 watt one. And the black hole forms between me and you, so when this shell goes in, you just see my lamp going down, the intensity going down, being so redshifted that I just disappear. And then after time m squared, you should see me again, right? The point is that now everything is reversed, so there's not an exponential redshift, but there's an exponential blue shift. And you can compute what is the intensity of the lamp that you see, and you would see the original intensity times an exponential blue shift of the order of exponential of the mass of the black hole divided by M Planck with your parameters. This would be brighter than 1,000 suns. So if I translate this into a small perturbation in the metric, I would say that this metric is unstable.
And this is kind of the reason people are used for talking about instability in the horizons. It's the same thing, the piling of the effect.
Yeah.
Yes, I don't know if this is related to my questions before. You're not talking about the wavelength of a light forming the black hole. You're talking about a wavelength of a light moving on this geometry. Is that correct or not?
That's correct. Any text particle could be even a tennis ball that I throw in.
Yeah, it's the metric is as it is time symmetric invariant. Right, it's time reversal invariant. So all the phenomena that you have, you can imagine over it are time reversal invariant. Now, this is not very physical, of course, because in the world there is dissipation. So on top of this metric, there should be the dissipation given by Hawking radiation, the dissipation given by the fact that whatever falls in doesn't fall in just one shell, but falls in a sequence of things that get mixed up, and so on and so forth. But But asymmetric is today, it's time reversal invariant. So there is the analog of the Hawking radiation redshift, if you want. In Hawking radiation, you can have a very high frequency signal coming out at a low frequency signal, and here you can have both. Of course, you can have the time reversal of that. I think that all this has to be studied. I before studying the stability of that, I would like to have a more realistic version of this picture, because the exactly symmetric non-spherically rotating case seems to be a bit extreme. I mean, funny things can happen. I expect the future to be different than the past, things to dissipate, apparent singularities coming in this case to disappear. And but most importantly, I would say that there is one more important check of this, whether this is stable, not in the sense of that you're saying, but this is stable against rotations. Now, is there a rotating version of this metric? Because if it did exist, I might believe that a physical object can behave in this manner. If it doesn't, I'm not sure I believe it. So these are the kind of questions which I think should, a theoretical question that should be asked in this scenario. Now, if in this if the situation with a rotating hole is the same as the non as this one, as the non-rotating black hole, and if physically there is a concentration of energy somewhere, well, this concentration and energy will have physical effect. So it will distort the metric itself. This metric is has as a source outside the quantum region only the shell. So if you add some other source, it's not going to be a solution, of course. And if you try to have some other some light moving over it, and this light concentrates, focuses in some point, then where it focuses, it will create curvature, and it will distort it. So I think this is the direction in which these questions can be analyzed.
Okay, thank you.
More questions?
I have a question. So it's a little bit confusing to me what happens at the horizon when you transition from the black hole to the white hole, because, of course, a black hole horizon and a white hole horizon have very different properties. And the horizon is very far away from the singularity. So I would expect things to behave something like classical general relativity near that area. But something very strange must be happening there. Do you have any insight about that? I suppose if you look at the metric, you should see what's happening.
Yes. Yes. If you look, I mean, we were on slide 24, if you're still there. You see that the quantum region leaks out from the horizon. The horizon is a green thing. So if you are at a finite distance from the horizon and you stay at a finite distance from the horizon, what you see is just a standard black hole horizon for a very long time. And then there is a region where the Einstein equations are not satisfied. And there is where the effect of the tunneling takes place, and it's a violation of the equation. Essentially, if you want to think, if you want to imagine this in a sort of Eddington physicist-like coordinates, you have to think at the light cones that start moving up and moving down. One way of thinking about that is to look at the t equals zero surface. The t equals zero surface is it's a symmetry surface, so the light cone there must be all vertical, right? They cannot fold neither inside nor outside to be for the thing to be time reversible. So if you want, for a moment, the gravity weakens enormously and then becomes repulsive.
It's just surprising to me that there would be such strong quantum effects near the horizon.
The strong quantum effect near the horizon are the key of all that, and all this comes from the sort of the minimal the question the question you're posing it is it where is the classical or the semi-classical approximation reliable, right? And is it reliable everywhere the curvature is not Planckian, or the effective metric might be affected also when the curvature is small? And the suggestion here is that the quantum effects might pile up over a long time and affect the metric even where the curvature is small. If you think about this, it happens in plenty of quantum phenomena, including Hawking radiation, right? If you're a finite distance from the horizon and wait a sufficient amount of time and you believe the classical theory, nothing should come out. But if the black hole explodes, it does come out. And Hawking predicted an explosion at the end of a black hole. So the classical theory does become unreliable after a sufficient long time. The point is that the conformal diagram, as usual, are misleading in the sense that the point delta seems nearby in time, but is very the physics is may happen because the time between the incoming shell delta and the outgoing shell is very large. But yes, there is some quantum physics that leaks out from the horizon at some point.
Carlo, could we go back to slide 33?
Yes.
We are going back here. Okay. So, I mean, let me just make a preliminary remark and then ask the question. I mean, as Eugenio says, I think it really is very, very nice that, you know, this really changes. It really challenges a standard paradigm, right? I mean, saying that new things can happen and opens up a new window. And that is why any time you challenge a paradigm which has been around for a while, then, of course, you know, it has to be scrutinized in great detail with big magnifying glass, right? I mean, so...
Can I interrupt before you pose the question? Can I say one thing?
Yeah.
It does challenge some paradigm, but it does not, is not contrary to the paradigm of... you know, that was in the paper of yours and Bojovald, or in the idea of the apparent horizon that disappears, the trapped region. It's a way of trying to make it sharper.
Right. No, I think, no, absolutely. So I think the whole point is that it sort of reinforces the idea that we had, and other people had, saying that, well, event horizons should not be really taken so seriously at all.
Yeah.
Right, in classical quantum gravity. And what we can talk about is only the dynamical horizons which form and which can evaporate, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, I completely agree with that. But I think the beautiful thing about this is that in some it doesn't really depend on which quantum theory of gravity you're talking about, right? I mean, because you never talked about loop quantum gravity or string theory or anything like that. You bring in H-bar only for some certain considerations, and you violate. You say that, well, there will be a region in which classical equations are violated, and you're not even saying how it is violated. Your conclusions don't depend so crucially on what exactly the metric is in that region, apart from these parameters which do depend on H-bar. Okay. So that's very nice. But if I look at this slide 33, I mean, the point is that you also want to make the case that, in fact, the Hawking radiation takes enormous amount of time compared to this phenomena. But the Hawking radiation calculation about how long will the black hole last is really its life at scry for an observer at infinity. How long is this black hole going to last? So if I take your radius r, I mean your world line of this observer, if I increase it increasingly more and more, your time also goes to infinity, right? It doesn't.
Yeah.
So it's not clear to me. I think you're somehow, when you are saying that, well, your time is much shorter than Hawking time, Hawking evaporation time, you're comparing apples with oranges. And I kind of get the feeling that it's not a fair comparison here. Because we never talk about, you know, Hawking, how long some observer in the middle of space-time is going to see. the life of a black hole. So I think that's not quite fair.
We were long confused about that, and I think the answer is exactly in the formula on the slide 33 that you pointed out, this tau. Tau goes to infinity if r goes to infinity, obviously, because there's r minus a inside. So in other words, if I am at infinite distance and I see a light going in, of course it takes an infinite time to come out. But there are two different things. In Hawking theory, if I am at a large distance from the actual collapsing star, then I see the star exploding after a time which is given by the time it takes the light of the explosion to come to me, or if you want the time it takes the matter to collapse, plus a time of order m cube, plus. And here is the same thing. If I am at a finite distance, I see something collapsing, I see the explosion coming out, and the time between these two events is given by the time it takes the thing to collapse, plus the time it takes to the light comes out, plus something of order n squared. In the example of slide 33, is the plus something proportional to the logarithm of a minus 2m, something that diverges, which is independent on the other divergence, which is if I go to infinity. Which, if you think, imagine that the Hawking theory is true, and we live long enough to see the explosion of a stellar black hole. The stellar black hole is a finite distance from us, and we can compute at a finite distance how long it takes for us to see the star exploding after it has collapsed. So this is the correct calculation. The going to infinity is fine, but it's just a way to avoid doing the full proper calculation.
Right, but therefore, if I, in the Hawking calculation, if I remain at a finite distance, right, then it's not clear to me what the comparison is.
It's still m cube.
Okay, I'll think about this with Eugenio and Mathieu. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
More questions?
I think this question that Eugenio asking to me is a central question. And I think that additional rotation is, of course, important, but I don't think that's directly relevant for the viability of this scenario. Because, after all, if you look at a classical theory, right, I mean, we have Schwarzschild black holes, and people studied stability of Schwarzschild black hole, and much before they studied stability of Kerr black hole. In fact, the stability of Kerr black hole, mathematicians would say nonlinear stability, is even not established even today. Okay, so I could just consider the Schwarzschild black hole, and in this case, one could consider a spherical symmetric object that is falling in. And I think Eugenio's point is that if at early times I have just a small perturbation, then what comes out is at scribe plus, then there is a huge effect near where the shell comes out. Slightly to the future, but almost there. And therefore, this scenario is not stable. I think that is, to me, because the strength of your argument is, in some sense, that it all depends primarily on it doesn't depend on the details of the quantum gravity theory. Therefore, for that reason, I think this stability is very, very important. And to me, at least to the extent I understand it, this Eugenio's argument of stability is very similar to the idea of what happens to the instability of the inner horizons. It is the same piling up effect that is occurring in both cases. And for that reason, we strongly believe that inner horizons in classical general relativity are not stable, they're not really physical, they're not really there. And so for this reason, I think this coming out of the shell, which in some sense is associated with this inner horizon, if you think about it, it is outer and inner horizon meet and so on and so forth. So that, I think, is really, that stability is a very important part for the viability of this scenario. Again, let me repeat. There are two independent points. One is that you and your colleagues have opened a window, right, saying that there is a way of looking at this whole black hole evaporation information, et cetera, in a completely different perspective. That, I think, is pretty robust. But the precise idea that the incoming shelf comes out, that may have to be modified quite a bit. I mean, the two things are not the same thing, right? I mean, one can still work with you with your new paradigm and do something else.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, the actual metric we have written is it's very crude on a number of reasons, and this stability issue is one. Eugenio and Matteo have done calculations of Hawking radiation over this metric, and they get, I think it's related to what Eugenio is saying, they get this big energy impulse coming out, which indicated that if you have quantum fields over it, this has to change a lot. So I agree. I mean, I think that the detail of the solution itself should not be taken to should definitely not be taken as an arrival point. To me, what was surprising is that there exists an external solution for Einstein equations where things fall in into a black hole and comes out as a white hole, approximately a white hole and approximate black hole. Perhaps this can be declined in a number of more precise ways, taking account more a number of questions and issues.
Okay, I guess since it's 10:30, there might be more questions. I think we should just thank Carlo again.